Drive Time on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. Trust over 40 years of experience providing innovative pension solutions. Zurich Corporate Pensions. Visit zurichcorporate.ie to learn more.
The Republic's labour force broke the 2.5 million barrier for the first time in the state's history in the first 3 months of 2022. That's according to the latest figures from the CSO. Joining us on the line now to discuss this is Tánaiste and Minister for Enterprise, Trade and Employment, Leo Varadkar. And Tánaiste, you're very welcome to the programme this evening.
Thank you. Good evening.
So we might start with those figures from the CSO. A significant milestone for Ireland.
Yeah, it's a very significant and very positive milestone. You know, only 20 or 30 years ago, there were only a million people at work in Ireland. And today we see that we're at 2.5 million, which is the highest ever level. And means that we've met our employment target a year ahead of schedule. And when you dig down into the numbers, it tells an interesting story as well. So female participation in the workforce is at a record high. Youth unemployment is at a record low. And we're really seeing some good regional spread in terms of new jobs created in the past year. So the biggest increases, the double-digit increases in employment last year occurred in the southwest and the southeast. And the southeast had previously been an unemployment black spot. We now see the lowest levels of unemployment down the western seaboard in the western, midwestern and southwestern regions. So, you know, a lot of work has gone in the past few years into trying to achieve balanced regional development. That work is still underway, whether it's the technology universities or the National Broadband Plan or the IDA's Regional Property Programme. But we're starting to see some real results and some good results and getting to the point where we're not far off full employment. And that's where there's a job for anyone who wants one in all parts of the country. And that's the objective.
And obviously that is a very positive news story that there's a job for anyone who wants one.
Not quite there yet, but we're almost there.
Almost there, but sort of running in parallel to that then, we're hearing increasingly from employers that there's actually serious issues trying to find workers, particularly the hospitality industry, with getting staff. Is there a danger that we're going to run out of workers?
Well, first of all, I just want to thank the business community and employers and indeed Irish workers for getting us to this point. We've bounced back faster than almost any economy in Europe since the pandemic. And some of that's down to government policies, but a lot of it is down to the ability and resilience of the Irish workforce and business leaders in particular, and want to recognise that and thank them for it. We are now seeing labour shortages in pretty much every sector of the economy, to be frank. It's very evident in the hospitality sector for lots of reasons, but you know, you'll even see it in the tech sector. We see it in the public service as well. So that in some ways is the downside of having such high levels of employment. But you know, I'd much rather be dealing with that challenge, and it is a real challenge, than where we were 10 or 12 years ago, where there was mass unemployment and you know, people were leaving the country.
Okay,
because,
so in terms of
how
we are dealing with that challenge, though, because it is a really serious challenge. John Cook was reporting from Galway yesterday about pubs that are only opening 2 or 3 days a week because they simply can't get the staff. You can see how, if that situation was to persist throughout the summer, how businesses could start to run into really serious difficulty. Now, the Business Post was reporting last February there's a backlog in your department of 10,500 work visa applications for workers to come from abroad to work here. There's a backlog of 10,500. And they quoted a department spokesperson from your department saying that there were plans to speed up processing times. Has that backlog now been cleared a couple of months later?
Not cleared, but it's down from 10,000 to 6,000. And we've trebled the number of staff working in that work permit section. So for critical skills, it's about a 6-week turnaround, which, you know, is our target. For what they call general employment permits, it can still take 16 to 18 weeks, but that's improving and will improve a lot over the next few weeks.
Because the Business Post was quoting employers just last Sunday, saying the average waiting time they're encountering is 6 to 8 months for visa approvals, and they just can't get the staff.
Well, for critical skills, which would be the skilled people coming in, it's about 6 weeks. For general employment permit, which would be people who would be limited skills or low skills, that's about 18 weeks, but it is coming down, and the backlog is half what it was. And we will issue more work permits this year than any other year. You know, the reason for the increase is that employers are struggling to find staff, not just in Ireland, but in the European Union. But I would say this, though, and I think it is important to say this, you know, issuing work permits is only part of the solution. And bear in mind, anyone we bring into the country, that we'd provide provide housing and accommodation for them as well. So, you know, what we'd like to do as much as we can is actually free up more people who are here to take part in the workforce if they're willing to. And, you know, one of the things that I'm a very strong advocate of is reducing the cost of childcare in the next budget. And I think that would enable a lot of parents to get back to work sooner if they want to, or to, you know, participate more in the workforce. Very hard to do that at the moment, given the cost of childcare. One thing Simon Harris is examining at the moment as well is the way the SUSE grants work. So if a student, for example, works over the summer period or works while they're in college, if they earn more than 4,000 euros, they start to lose out on their entitlement to the grant. So, you know, that's a perverse disincentive, and we're looking at that as whether we can change it. And then there is the wider picture of pay terms and conditions. And, you know, a lot of people who used to work in hospitality during the pandemic moved to retail, where they don't have to work as many weekends or as many evenings. And, you know, the truth is, although I know maybe hard for some employers to hear, part of the solution is going to be things like improvement in pay and terms and conditions. And there's no one thing that's going to fix this. We're going to have to come at it from a few different angles.
Another issue raised by employers is that Ireland has a newfound reputation as an unattractive place to live and work in terms of getting people to come here to work. One HR manager, quoting the Business Post again last weekend, said that they asked people of various nationalities why they wouldn't come here, and the number one reason was accommodation. They can't find somewhere to live, or if they do, it's too expensive.
Look, there's no doubt that Ireland, and particularly Dublin, is an expensive place to live, and it's very hard to find rental accommodation at the moment. And people coming here from abroad would generally rent rather than buy, at least initially. But if you look at the facts, we have very significant inward migration into Ireland. There are many more people coming into the country every year than are leaving it. And even in terms of Irish citizens, there are more Irish citizens returning to Ireland every year than are leaving Ireland for abroad. So, you know, if you look at the bigger picture, it's obvious to anyone that this is an attractive place to come and live in by virtue of the fact that our population is increasing every year. And that's not just because of the birth rate, it's because of Irish citizens coming home and people from other parts of Europe and the world wanting to come here. But there is no doubt that one of the major barriers to, you know, future growth and barriers to people having a decent standard of living is the cost of accommodation, the availability of somewhere to rent, the fact that rents are so high, and that it's so difficult for people to buy their own home. But, you know, other places face similar problems. San Francisco, Seattle, New York, you'll find the same problems too.
Yeah, I just wonder, though,
for example,
relying on
New
mothers.
Zealand, the average house price now is 800,000 euros, I think.
If we're relying on mothers making the decision to leave their children and go back into the workforce because childcare costs have come down by an unspecified amount, and I'd imagine they would have to come down quite significantly in a lot of cases, you know, it sounds like a bit of a wing and a prayer to make sure the workforce is adequately staffed.
Well, then, apparently, I didn't say that. You know, I said that we do have an emerging problem of labour shortages across the economy, and there is no one thing that will fix it. So it's not just work permits. It's not just reducing the cost of childcare or the cost of rent. It's also about those things. It's about better pay terms and conditions. It's also about training, education and activation. We do have a lot of people who are still in the live register receiving job seekers benefit, people on disability payments who would like to work if they're properly supported. So training, education and activation is part of the picture as well.
All right, I might move on to a story developing today because, as I know you're aware, autism campaigners are very angry about this plan from your colleague, Minister Josepha Madigan, about opening temporary special education centres around Dublin because there's simply no places for some children in mainstream schools. Now, I know you held a meeting with the Darmody family this afternoon. What did they tell you and what did you say to them?
Yeah, well, I suppose that was a private meeting and, you know, I wouldn't want to speak too much about it, but it was great to meet the family. And as you know, the youngest daughter there, who's 11, is raising money at the moment. She's actually doing the junior cert maths exam, believe it or not. An 11-year-old is doing it, and she's raising money for special needs and special ed. But she actually has two younger brothers who are in a special school, and they're very happy with that special school because that's right for the particular needs that they have. But the policy of government, and this is very definitely the policy of government, is one of integration and is one of mainstreaming, because, you know, you can't have an integrated society where people with disabilities are integrated into our society if you don't start with integrated schools.
Okay, so that's the policy, and yet your junior minister is working on a proposal to do the opposite of that, not integration, have centres where children with disabilities would be educated in what we're told is a short term, or indeed a stopgap, I think is the language that is used. What is short term?
Well, you know, I think this is something that Mr. Madigan is today engaging with the sector, with parents, with teachers, with interest groups, to kind of tease out and explain what's being proposed here. You know, it's not a move back towards special schools. You know, it definitely isn't that.
What is it, though? What is short term?
This is something that she's engaging on now at the moment.
Does that mean that hasn't been decided?
No. And, you know, I think what kind of came out last night, you know, wasn't particularly helpful. I can imagine parents, you know, wouldn't have liked what they saw on Twitter or what they read last night, because there hadn't been proper engagement or proper discussion. But just to give you an example, you know, we have a special education minister for the first time, and it's not just a title. The budget's €2 billion. For every €4 we now spend in our schools, one gets spent on special education. That was never the case before. Mm. And in the last year alone, 300 extra special classes have been opened in mainstream schools.
No, and I do understand that thought. We've been discussing it on the show over the last couple of weeks, and yet there are still 80 children in Dublin at the moment who don't have a school place to go to, who require a class in a mainstream school. And I think there's another 50 on top of that who require a class in a special school, and they have nowhere to go. So this is a proposal that's been worked on by your junior minister. We don't know what short term is. Do we know what these centres will look like? Are they going to be prefabs? Do we know, will they be built beside mainstream schools?
We don't, or at least I don't. And, you know, that's why meetings are happening today to consult on this, to talk to parents, talk to teachers, talk to people involved in the sectors to what the best solution is.
You know, it's May, though. You know, it's coming towards the end of May. So these children are looking for a school place come September.
Well, you know, there are a number of options, and this would obviously be all subject to parental choice. So, for example, there is the option of home tuition, and that's used in some circumstances. And there's also the option of using the Education Act. I think it's Section 37A of the Education Act, where the minister can direct schools
But the minister herself said over the last 24 hours that one of the reasons she was looking at this idea of special centres was because that 37A provision takes a bit of time to implement.
But it can be done.
September, you know. So it feels a little bit like this is being made up as you go along. You know, there's a bit of a sense of that.
No, I don't think that's fair. You know, I was at a meeting last night with parents and teachers from Dublin 15, from my constituency. There was a shortage of 17 places in the area. We were able to create 22 because four schools agreed to take on mainstream classes. So that's something that we're working on at the moment. I think where we have fallen down, and I do accept that there are deficiencies here, is that forward planning hasn't been as good as it might have been in the past. And I found it hard to get my head around why that is, because, you know, particularly when it comes to secondary school places, you know, you would think it'd be fairly obvious that people coming through primary school would need a secondary school place, but actually
really
not that simple now that I understand it.
Your government and the government that you were part of before now.
You know, I'm never going to come on your programme and say that we've always got everything right. We haven't. Special education is an area where I think we've got more right than wrong. You know, we've more special needs assistance than ever before. I think we've got 20,000 now, more than there are Gardaí. There were none, you know, not that long ago, 20 years or so ago. And we've 15,000 special education teachers now, and we're absolutely committed to a policy of integration. And if you go to any school in Ireland now, I'd be surprised if you don't see, you know, a special unit in it. And that's all happened because of our time in government. Don't always get it right. This is something that's going to require, I think, some consultation and a bit of work, and we will get it right.
Just a couple of other things I want to ask you about briefly. The passport service. I know you were at a press conference earlier today, and you were saying that it's possible that, and correct me if I'm wrong about this, that it's possible the passport service may move to online only for renewals. Is that correct? Mm. And how would that help the situation?
Well, it's one of the possible things that we could do to help with the situation. There is a big backlog at the moment of people applying for passports, and that's causing a lot of stress for people. You can imagine what it's like if you have to cancel a holiday. You know, many people haven't been abroad for years, visiting family and friends, families being split. So it's a huge issue, as you can imagine, coming through TD's constituency offices. So when it comes to renewals, actually, if the renewals are done online, people are getting their new passports. passport in less than 7 days, and 2 and 3 days in some cases. Mm. Where the real problem is with the paper applications. Now, applications for new passports have to be done by paper because, you know, photographs have to be witnessed and all that type of thing. And checks have to be done in relation to children and child protection.
But what about people who may find it difficult to access the internet or use the internet? You're telling them now that's not going to be an option for them to renew their passport.
No, I'm not telling anyone anything. I'm saying this is one of the options that we're considering.
And would you have any concerns for those people who aren't, you know, internet savvy?
I think what we found in the past, you know, whether it was with the vaccine program, whether it was with the over 70s medical card, 97 or 98% of over 70s got their medical cards online. I remember being told at the time that older people wouldn't be able to use the internet or wouldn't be able to get somebody they knew or their family to do that, and okay. Actually they did. So, you know, I'm not saying this is ideal, but if by going online only, can be part of the solution, but then it needs to be considered. But the other things we need to do too, like there's a lot of, about 40% of the forms, you know, aren't being filled in properly. That must be a problem with the forms. You know, if it was 4%, I might think it was the applicants, but if it's 40%, there's something wrong with the forms. And the other thing as well, you know, obviously is an increase in staff and resources. There's 900 staff now in the passport offices. They are all back to work physically, obviously on premises. And another thing that we're considering is opening a third passport office, one perhaps in the Galway Sligo in the west of the country area, which could really help, you know, for people in the west to obviously find it much harder to travel to Dublin or to Cork to do things in person.
Briefly, I want to ask you about Northern Ireland, and following a meeting with the US delegation in Belfast today, unionist parties have described it as the most undiplomatic visit and unhelpful. Unionists very unhappy with Richard Neal, the congressman in particular. Do you think it's possible Richard Neal's visit has caused more damage than good?
You know, I don't believe so. You know, we often talk about the British and Irish governments being co-guarantors of the Good Friday Agreement. And in many ways, I think the United States is the third guarantor in many ways. And if you go back to the origins of the Good Friday Agreement, you know, America, Clinton administration, others were very involved in that. So, you know, I think input from America is very useful. Sometimes they bring an outside perspective, which is always helpful. And also the government in London, the government in Westminster, don't always listen to us, but they do listen to America. You know, it's a powerful country, a big trading partner. They want to do a trade deal with them, a very important security partner for Britain too. And the fact that America takes an interest in Irish affairs, I think is to the benefit of all of us on the island. And, you know, if it wasn't for people like Richie Neal, people like Pete King going back, not sure there would have been a Good Friday Agreement.
I'll ask you finally, Tánaiste, about a story we've been discussing about the Punchestown races and the attendance by a number of politicians at the races as guests of the Irish Bookmakers Association. Do you think it's appropriate for politicians who will be voting potentially on legislation relating to the gambling industry, regulating the gambling industry, to be attending an event at which they're getting free food, free drink, mixing socially with representatives from that industry?
You know, I think, you know, the reality is that politicians meet with lobby groups all the time, and sometimes that's in a social setting. You know, I'm the minister responsible for business. I would have been at business dinners would have obviously not you know, would have been a business event, and the person hosting it would have paid for the meal. I've been at trade union dinners, you know, I've been at IFA dinners, so you know, and they represent the farmers. So, you know, I think we need to be a little bit considered about this. It's not unusual for politicians to engage with lobby groups, and it's not unusual for them to do that sometimes in a social setting, whether
but
it's a chamber commerce dinner or an IFA dinner.
That they're covered by the lobbying legislation, aren't they?
Yeah,
you know,
and
you can understand the appearance, if not the reality of this, that there's these powerful lobby groups getting access to people in power. They're currying favour with them by giving them a good day out for free, and they're doing it all in a way that none of us, the public, would know about it, because it's not required to be registered under the lobbying legislation because of the nature of the event. Can you understand how that's very concerning to people? And also, you know, politicians are humans too. So if someone brings you out and gives you a good day out, and then they're legislation relating to them comes across your desk, you might be more inclined to look favourably upon it.
Well, you know, I obviously wasn't at the event myself, but there are very strict rules around this, and I don't think any rules here were broken or any guidelines were breached.
No, and we're not saying they were, but the question is, should there be stricter rules in a way that wouldn't allow this sort of event and these sort of social interactions, or presented as social interactions, which actually at which I suppose connections are being made that could influence legislation?
No, you know, my understanding under the Lobbying Act is that if any lobbying does occur, it is the responsibility of the person carrying out the lobbying to declare that. It actually doesn't matter whether it's an informal or social scenario. So I think that is the case actually under the law, but I might just double check that, but that was my recollection.
Okay. Tá, Thomas Leo Vraker, thank you very much for joining us this evening. We'll take a break.